Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I host the program with Carrie Figder and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Greg Caruso. Greg is professor of philosophy at SUNY Corning, visiting fellow at the New College of the Humanities in London, and honorary professor of philosophy at Macquarie University. Greg also co-directs the Justice Without Retribution Network at the University of Aberdeen School of Law. Greg's research lies at the intersections of metaphysics, philosophy of mind, cognitive science, ethics, political and legal philosophy. His new book has just been published by Cambridge University Press. It's titled Rejecting Retributivism, Free Will, Punishment, and Criminal Justice. According to an intuitive view, those who commit crimes are justifiably subject to punishment. Depending on the severity of the wrongdoing that constitutes the crime, punishment can be severe. It can be incarceration, confinement, various forms of deprivation, and so on. The common thought is that in committing serious crimes, persons render themselves deserving of punishment by the state. Punishment is simply then a matter of giving offenders their just deserts. Call this broad view retributivism. What if retributivism's underlying idea of desert is fundamentally confused? What if persons lack the kind of free will that could make them deserving of punishment in the sense that retributivism requires? This is the central question addressed in Greg Caruso's new book. After arguing against the idea that persons can be deserving of punishment in the retributivist sense, Caruso develops an alternative approach to criminal behavior. Now, as usual, there's a lot to talk about. But why don't we begin, as we always do, with our guest. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to be talking to you. How are you today?
Good, very good.
I'm glad to hear that. Thanks for writing such a wonderful book. We usually start these discussions by asking the author to say a little bit about himself. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Greg?
Yeah, so I was born and raised on Long Island in a small town named Malvern. I have five older brothers, and so I was the first really to pursue an academic life. Most of my brothers, went into, careers in real estate and building and development and carpentry. I went on to college at William Patterson University, where actually we met.
That's true.
Yeah, we were college mates. And I actually went to study jazz initially. I was a jazz major. I was an upright bass player. Mm-hmm. And William Patterson had one of the best jazz programs in the country. And that's why I had attended. And I just started taking some philosophy courses. And along the way, I had met you and a few other students who were there at the time. And we started, little reading groups in philosophy. And my interest just got drawn more and more in the direction of doing philosophy. And so eventually I switched over from jazz to philosophy. And you were largely influential in that in terms of our conversations and our reading groups. And you were a little ahead of me, I think, right? A year or two.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And you sort of paved the path for some of us. So you went on eventually to NYU and then the Graduate Center, the CUNY Graduate Center. And I followed you to the CUNY Graduate Center.
It's true.
So I was always sort of half a step behind you. But yeah, so I ended up getting my PhD in philosophy from the City University of New York, and then went on and, have ended up here in SUNY Corning.
That's fabulous. And, if I'm remembering correctly, your interest in sort of issues about agency and responsibility and free will, developed a little bit later that, yeah. For most of the time when you were working as a graduate student, you were more strictly working in philosophy of mind and consciousness. Was that right?
Yeah. So I was originally, doing cognitive science, philosophy of mind, studied under David Rosenthal there at CUNY. And then when it came time to write the dissertation, I originally was planning on writing on consciousness. And at some point, I can't remember how it came about, we ended up having a reading group on free will. And there was about 3 graduate students at the time who were interested in issues. I had never taken a course in free will, actually, during my graduate career. And I started to realize at that time that I could apply some of the stuff I was doing in philosophy of mind and agency and link it up with some of the material that I was reading and learning about free will. And my dissertation ended up being on consciousness and free will, which ended up turning into my first book, which was titled Free Will and Consciousness. largely the project there was to kind of look at the link between consciousness and free will, but also to provide a account of what I would consider the phenomenology of free will, the phenomenology of agency. And since I think free will is an illusion, part of my project in that book was to give an account of how that sort of phenomenological illusion arises by combining aspects that I was doing in philosophy of mind, cognitive science, and the basically recent developments in the behavioral cognitive neurosciences with basically a theoretical account of consciousness. So once I ended up getting drawn into that area via the philosophy of mind literature, I just got deeper and deeper into it. Eventually people started to ask me what the practical implications of my view were, what would I say about morality and moral responsibility and criminal punishment and interpersonal relationships. And so I ended up going down this rabbit hole where I started to work more and more on the practical implications and the policy implications of my view on free will. And I'm still in that process, basically. And so this book is an attempt to explain how my view cashes out in the arena of criminal justice and what its implications would be for criminal law and public policy.
Fabulous. So that's a really nice segue then into sort of digging into the book. Let's start at the beginning with some of the points you were just making. So you defend a view about free will that is sometimes called hard incompatibilism. Sometimes it's called also free will skepticism. Sometimes people call it illusionism, I think. Tell us a little bit about the view, and can you, I know this is a long standing and pretty wide ranging series of debates, but can you sort of give us the listeners sort of a place your view within the more familiar maybe to most listeners, the more familiar positions within the debate over free will.
Yeah, sure. So maybe some definitions would be helpful at this point. So free will skepticism, I think, is for me a sort of broader category of views. It's a family of views that sort of either doubt or deny the existence of free will. And historically, the main account that defended free will skepticism was a view called hard determinism. And hard determinism was the thesis that determinism is true, where determinism is the thesis that facts about the remote past in conjunction with the laws of nature entail there's only one unique future. That determinism is true and incompatible with free will, either because it's incompatible with, say, the ability to do otherwise, which some people think is a necessary condition for free will, or that determinism is incompatible with the agent being the appropriate source of their actions, which is sometimes called source incompatibilism. So that view, hard determinism, was popular at the sort of at the peak of Newtonian physics. So you get this view being espoused by people like Simone de Laplace and Spinoza. Actually, Albert Einstein also held this view. And so that view has sort of faded a little bit because there because of the emergence of quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics, the final verdict is out in terms of what the final interpretation of quantum mechanics will be. But there are indeterminist interpretations of quantum mechanics that suggest that maybe universal determinism isn't true. So different types of views have emerged out of that. And the view that you mentioned, hard incompatibilism, is the view that the sort of free will required for what I call basic desert moral responsibility is incompatible both with the truth of determinism and also the kind of indeterminacy in action that would be required by the most plausible versions of what's called libertarianism. So my view is essentially that we lack free will either way. We lack free will whether the universe is fundamentally deterministic or indeterministic. And so it's called hard incompatibilism because the idea is that free will is incompatible both with determinism and with indeterminism. So the overarching view I hold, which I call free will skepticism, basically maintains that who we are and what we do is ultimately the result of factors beyond our control. And now we could see that maybe that includes either determinism or indeterminism. And because of that, we're never morally responsible in a very particular sense. So it's probably best that I define what I mean by free will at the beginning as well. So I define free will as the control and action that's required for a very particular and pervasive notion of moral responsibility, which in the literature, some people refer to as basic desert moral responsibility. So this is the kind of moral responsibility that would make agents truly deserving of praise or blame or punishment or reward in what's called a purely backward-looking sense. So understood this way, free will is the kind of power ability an agent would have in and must possess in order to justify certain kinds of basically deserved attitudes, judgments, and treatments, like certain types of reactive attitudes, certain types of responses like blame, like retribution. And the idea is that essentially on this notion of basic desert, for an agent to be morally responsible for their actions in this sense, they would have to be deserving of blame simply for having performed the action, not for what you might call consequentialist reasons,
right,
forward-looking reasons, or contractualist reasons. So basically, the agent deserves a certain type of judgment, attitude, or treatment simply for having performed the action. And for me, it's important to kind of link the idea of free will with this kind of moral responsibility, because for me, the historical debate about free will, what's been of central philosophical and practical importance in my view is this very central notion of moral responsibility. If I could just add something real quick here, I think this definition has a bunch of advantages also. It's a neutral definition. So virtually all the various parties in the debate can agree to this without, the definition doesn't exclude any view at the outset. So for example, compatibilism is the view that determinism and free will are compatible. Libertarianism, not to be confused with political libertarianism, right, is the metaphysical view that free will and determinism are incompatible, but that we do have some kind of indeterminate free will. if you were to define free will as requiring the unconditional ability to do otherwise, that would sort of favor the libertarian and exclude compatibilism. Right. If you were to define free will in terms of reason's responsiveness, that would sort of beg the question in favor of the compatibilist. Mm-hmm. So by defining free will as the control and action required for more responsibility, it leaves all of these views open. And then it asks, well, what kind of control is needed to make an agent responsible in this way? I also think it captures the practical importance of the debate, because if we're not debating issues that connect up with more responsibility or various practices and attitudes and policies and judgments, it's hard to see what the debate's about.
Right.
And I also think it fits with our everyday understanding. We generally understand free will as intertwined with moral responsibility. There's a lot of experimental philosophy that seems to indicate that ordinary folk view things this way. And lastly, if you reject this definition of free will, it makes it difficult to understand what the substantive dispute is really about. Because there are various forward-looking practices that even a free will skeptic could adopt.
Sure.
For pragmatic purposes, for consequentialist reasons, without necessarily saying agents deserve, in some basic sense, to be treated in a certain way. So I think it really captures the kind of core aspect of the free will problem.
Excellent. Excellent. That's very good and clarifies a lot. So again, just picking up on what you just said. So one of the central theses of the book, one of those sort of main threads that runs at least through the first part of the book, is that the truth of Harding compatibilism defeats retributivism as a theory of punishment, or perhaps it's a theory of what justifies punishment.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit, firstly, about why you think that Harding compatibilism the truth of Harding compatibilism defeats retributivism? And then I would also invite you to just say a little bit about how, and I thought this was a very nice and helpful feature of the book, that, you know, basically you argue, well, look, if you're a Harding compatibilist, or if Harding compatibilism is true, retributivism is false. But hey, if you didn't get sold on the Harding compatibilist arguments, don't worry. I still have independent arguments against retributivism that don't require you to buy my free will skeptical view. So can you just sort of run us through those two phases of the anti-retributivism arguments?
Yeah, sure. Let me just say the general structure of the book real quick is essentially two halves with one kind of transitional chapter in the middle. So the first half of the book is essentially me trying to lay out different arguments against retributivism. And I sort of developed six distinct arguments. And as you said, only two of them really depend upon free will. The other four that I present, I argue, are independent of issues over free will. So the first half of the book is my attempt to reject retributivism. There's a sort of transitional chapter where I talk about non-retributive alternatives that could also perhaps justify legal punishment. So consequentialist, deterrence-based models, mixed theories, communicative theories. And I reject those for sort of independent reasons, and maybe we could skip that. And then the whole second half of the book is my attempt to develop my alternative, which I'm sure we'll talk about. So in the first half, I lay out sort of six distinct arguments for rejecting the view known as retributivism. Let me just say quickly what that view is for the listeners. So within the criminal justice system, one of the most prominent justifications for legal punishment, both historically and currently, is something known as retributivism. And as you said in the introduction, essentially it's the view that absent any excusing conditions like mental illness or incompetency, wrongdoers are morally responsible for their actions and sort of deserve to be punished in proportion to their wrongdoing. So it maintains that essentially wrongdoers deserve something bad to happen to them just because they've knowingly done wrong. And that could include everything from pain, deprivation. Sadly, we still have the death penalty in the United States all the way up to death, right? But the two key aspects that you have to focus on is that essentially retributive punishment is grounded in the notion of sort of just desserts, as you said, mm-hmm. i.e. that individuals justly deserve to be punished simply for having done something wrong. But also, it's purely backward-looking. Right. So the retributivist thinks that the punishment is somehow intrinsically morally good. That is, it's good without reference to any additional goods or any forward-looking benefits. So the person would deserve to be punished even if it didn't deter crime, even if it didn't make us safer, even if it didn't help in the moral formation of the wrongdoer. The justification is simply looking backward at the wrongfulness of the act and then saying they should be punished in proportion to that wrongdoing. Right. And if you caught the definition I gave earlier of basic desert, well, that's exactly what basic desert moral responsibility says. It's purely backward looking. It's not consequential. So if I'm right, if we lack this kind of moral responsibility, this basic desert kind of moral responsibility, then retributive punishment would be unjustified because no one would basically deserve to suffer or be punished in this way that's required for retributivism, right? So if my views about free will are correct, then the philosophical justification for retributivism falls apart. And as long as we care about our legal practices being justified, then I argue we should reject retributivism as a foundation for these legal practices. But then, as I say, well, look, what if you're not convinced of my views on free will? And by the way, let me just quickly throw this in. Yes, I'm a Hardy incompatibilist, but I also offer a separate independent argument based on luck in the book.
Right.
Which some people refer to as hard luck. Neil Levy has a book named Hard Luck, which is a great title. but it's the idea of hard, again, like hard incompatibilism, hard determinism, that the pervasiveness of luck itself is incompatible with agents being free and morally responsible in the sense required for retributivism.
Right.
So in any case, I argue that there's sufficient reason for rejecting this notion of moral responsibility, exactly the notion that would be needed for retributivism. But then I offer what I call the epistemic argument. And this argument also relies on free will. So this argument, though, only requires a kind of weaker sense of skepticism.
Right.
So let's say you're not convinced that we lack free will. Okay. You think maybe there's a door open for compatibilism or for libertarianism. Well, the idea of the epistemic argument is to sort of shift the burden of proof. And I'll just kind of lay it out really quickly if I can. It basically says legal punishment intentionally inflicts harm on individuals, right? So when we punish individuals or when the state punishes a wrongdoer, they're intentionally inflicting some harm on that wrongdoer, deprivation, a removal of liberty, some sort of harsh treatment. And this treatment, obviously, when you look at the United States and our criminal justice system, could be quite harsh. We have a mass incarceration crisis. Our prisons are often, inhospitable, inhumane places. So legal punishment, intentionally inflicts a great deal of harm, potentially, on individuals.
Sure.
And the argument is that the justification for intentionally harming individuals has to reach a high epistemic bar. That is, you have to have good reason, a good justification for intentionally harming someone. If it's significantly probable that your justification for harming someone is not justified, then prima facie, there's something seriously morally wrong with harming someone. But what's the retributive justification for legal punishment? Well, it assumes that agents are free and morally responsible in exactly this sense under dispute in the free will controversy. And my argument is that if the assumption that individuals are free and morally responsible in this sense doesn't reach this high burden, this high bar that has to be met to justify intentionally harming wrongdoers, then it's, again, prima facie, seriously morally wrong to do so. And, well, this is a debate that's been waged for 2,000 years.
Right.
There's no clear consensus about whether agents have the kind of control and action required for basic desert moral responsibility. And my argument is that, look, even if you're not convinced that we lack free will, there's at least sufficient doubt that libertarian free will exists and that the accounts of libertarian free will could preserve what's needed. And compatibilism, I argue, if there's not much debate that we have the capacities that compatibilists point out. What's controversial is whether those capacities are sufficient to ground holding agents morally responsible in this basic desert sense. And since there's sufficient doubt, I argue we should suspend these practices that intentionally harm wrongdoers on the off chance that these, you know, extremely controversial notions are enough to justify treating individuals in this way. So this requires only a weaker sense of skepticism because it only requires that there's some doubt that these other notions of free will, libertarian and compatibilist notions, succeed. And actually, the burden I adopt in the book is the legal burden of beyond reasonable doubt.
Right.
And clearly, I argue we don't reach that level in this metaphysical debate about free will that we're so certain beyond reasonable doubt that we should then justify these practices. But beyond those two arguments, I then lay out sort of additional reasons that are completely independent of free will. And say, look, even if you don't agree with my views on free will, and even if you think there's a way around this epistemic argument, there's all kinds of other additional problems with retributivism. And one has been nicely recently defended in a book by, Aaron Kelly, called The Limits of Blame, where I call it the misalignment argument. Essentially, it says that there's a kind of fundamental misalignment between the legal standards of guilt, which we employ in criminal justice, and the philosophical standards of blameworthiness that even people who believe agents are free and morally responsible believe certain conditions have to be satisfied, and that there are all kinds of various ways that an agent could have diminished responsibility or mitigated responsibility. And so there's this fundamental misalignment between the legal standards of guilt and the criteria for blameworthiness. So things like adverse backgrounds, mental capacities. This is when me taking off my free will skeptic hat. Right. And so, like, even if you're a compatibilist or even if you're a libertarian, you acknowledge that there are various features of agents that could diminish their responsibility. So think of mental capacities. You know, we talk about agents who lack reasons responsive abilities, or agents who are suffering from Alzheimer's, or agents that are suffering some form of psychopathy or delusional states. And these could diminish one's responsibility in various ways. Well, the law is very coarse-grained. The law basically allows for an insanity defense. Right. And that's about it in terms of mental capacities. And legal standards for insanity are very hard to meet and are very seldom, and you know, insanity defenses very seldom work. And yet, so someone could be found legally guilty under the legal criteria of guilt, and yet still not satisfy the philosophical conditions for moral responsibility. And so there's this fundamental misalignment then between the two. And even for retributivists, that would mean some deserved offenders go unpunished and some undeserved offenders end up being punished. Right. And so I would argue that there is a large class of things that seldom get discussed, but things like adverse backgrounds, mental capacities, poverty, racism, mental illness short of insanity, that could affect one's blameworthiness if you think that kind of responsibility could still be preserved, and could diminish one's responsibility even when the legal criteria could be satisfied. And that's a problem. It's a problem for retributivists, especially since they think only deserved offenders should be punished. So in practice, it's very hard to implement. And then I sort of build on that and argue, well, look, you could say that that's a reason to improve our criminal justice system to try to get those two things better aligned, to reform things, to add additional defenses to the law. But then I introduce in a more imprincipled argument I call the poor epistemic position argument, or PEPA, as I like to call it. And it basically, it says, you know, look, to track the desert of individuals, the state would have to monitor and track everything they do, or a large class of actions. And A, that's sort of practically impossible. And B, it would lead to sort of a totalitarian state. No one would want to be in a state where the state was, you know, essentially tracking and monitoring individuals so as to properly align punishment in accordance with desert. And so the state's in a poor epistemic position to judge the desert of offenders. And that's because there are cognitive biases. There's a limit on time and resources the state has to look into the backgrounds of individuals to essentially judge the kind of large class of what I would consider mitigating factors that could reduce responsibility. And there's just too many factors to consider: poverty, adolescent development, racism, injustice, that could diminish the responsibility of agents. And so since the state's in a poor epistemic position, that is probably best that we adopt some approach that doesn't try to distribute punishment in accordance with desert, because it's virtually impossible for the state to properly to distribute punishment in accordance with desert. In part because they're in this poor epistemic position. And then one last one, and then I'll leave out the last argument. Sure. And this, I think, is a real fundamental problem. I argue that there's an indeterminacy in judgment. I call this the indeterminacy in judgment argument. So think of what the retributivist would have to do to properly judge what kind of punishment would be just. You imagine two columns, like in a ledger. And in one column, you have a rank ordering of the gravity of wrongs. So I get genocide, intentional murder. Those would be pretty high on the list, all the way down to like petty crime, right? So you got a rank ordering of gravity of wrongs. And then you're supposed to look across the ledger once you have the right ordering and figure out what the proportional punishment would be.
Yeah.
In the book, I go into great detail about this, that both columns, the gravity of wrong judgments and the proportionality judgments, are indeterminate. And they're subject to cultural biases, prejudice, power relations. And they're so indeterminate and elastic, I argue, that in a certain sense, retributivism doesn't provide any of the protections against disproportionate punishment that proponents argue it does. So I argue the purported protections one thinks you get with retributive punishment are actually more apparent than real. And so, for example, I use, you know, historical examples and current examples. One example is just homosexuality. In the past, it was considered a grievous wrong.
Right.
And it was considered punishable by death. And it was still outlawed in the UK, right? For many, many years. If anyone knows the story of Alan Turing, how his homosexuality was persecuted by the state. So it was, most people today wouldn't consider it a wrong at all, let alone proportionally punishable by death or some other shorter punishment. And then here's another one. Even if you get two retributivists to agree that, say, intentional murder, well, that's pretty bad. That's pretty high on the ranking of gravity of wrongs, probably right up there at the top. Right. So let's say that we could agree on that. Well, what's the proportional punishment? Kant thought death. Kant was a retributivist. He thought the only suitable punishment for murder was death. Well, most contemporary retributivists, but I would say a good deal of them would reject the death penalty.
Right.
So they agree that where it ranks in terms of its badness, but disagree on its proportional punishment. Some say maybe life in prison. Well, others might think life in prison is too disproportionate a punishment for that we should allow for the possibility of rehabilitation. And so even if you could agree on gravity, there's still so much subjective and indeterminate flux in terms of proportionality that essentially any cultural biases, any prejudice, any social injustices could be wrapped up into that into those judgments to justify extremely harsh punishments. So I'll just mention one last one is the sentencing disparity between powder cocaine and crack cocaine.
Yeah, right.
Right. And so there actually was historically something called the 100-to-1 ratio, where you would have to have 100 grams of powder cocaine equal the punishment that one gets for 1 gram of crack cocaine.
Wow. Yeah.
So one gram of crack cocaine got you 5 years in jail. To get the equivalent for powder, you needed 100 grams. So it's called the 100-to-1. There's no scientific or philosophical justification for that.
Right.
In terms of the pharmaceutical properties, they're equally bad for you. There's no real justification. The only real explanation you could come up with is racism. And so the what we considered proportional punishment for those differences in what we considered two different, acts with two different, in terms of the gravity of their wrong, two different, judgments. Is only grounded in who used powder cocaine and who used crack cocaine. Right. And so none of that could really be justified. And even the retributivists would acknowledge that. But my argument is that they can't cleanse their view of those kind of subjective judgments. And so in the end, ultimately, extremely harsh punishments could still be justified under the retributivist account, given that indeterminacy. And then there are additional arguments, but I don't want to get into all of them.
Yeah. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So can I ask a sort of a philosophical question? Because that series of arguments about the ledger, about the two sides of the ledger, got me thinking of a different kind of conceptual objection to retributivism. Because even if the retributivist says to the kinds of arguments that you've just said, well, we can refine our practices. We can, try to purge the subjectivist elements of, how we draw up the ledger. These are epistemic problems. It would still seem to me, though, that gradable punishments on a sort of scale of severity are always going to max out somewhere.
Yeah.
Right. So just like, I can only, the death penalty can be administered to a particular person only once. So if you say, well, if you kill 20 people, you get the death penalty.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then somebody kills 25.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It just seems to me conceptually you're required then, right?
Yeah.
To just say that, well, five people's lives didn't matter. And that just strikes me as a sort of just a conceptual problem with retributivism. If every version of it, and I think you're right that every version of it will have to be committed to some such, sort of two columns, how severe is the crime? What's the proportional punishment? Well, at some point there's no more punishment to give.
Yeah.
But you can still do things that are worse.
What's funny about that is that there actually have been cases where judges have handed down five life sentences to be served consecutively. Right. Or I think even Bernie Madoff or one of these really famous cases, the sentence was 125 years. Yeah. Now, these are obviously practically impossible punishments, right? No one lives five lives and, you know, no one lives for 125 years. But I think you're getting to something which is like, look, they want to be able to acknowledge that this is wronger than the one right beneath it.
Yeah.
On the ledger. And somehow that means we have to come up with these unreasonable and kind of comical excessive punishments to kind of keep that grading. On the fairness of the retributivist, I would say, you know, there have been attempts to answer these questions. There are what are called cardinal accounts of proportionality or ordinal accounts of proportionality. Sure. But in the book and elsewhere, I've tried to argue that each of those attempts at resolving the problem run into their own individual set of problems. So
good. So, you know, I take it that a lot of the, you know,
I could just jump in one last thought. I don't really raise this one in the book, but you had me thinking about it. And I thought maybe you were going to go there. You know, it's interesting that, you know, we have this view or some people have this view that, you know, the proper role of the state is to distribute punishment in accordance with desert. So we call that sort of negative desert, right? The kind of desert that people get for doing bad things. But almost no one thinks it would be the proper function of the state to distribute desert for good deeds.
Yeah, that's right.
And so it's kind of an interesting question as to whether the state should at all be in the business of trying to distribute either goods or, you know, benefits or punishments in accordance with desert, given that desert is such a kind of nefarious thing to judge and is subject to all kinds of epistemic limitations, as I said, and also, you know, biases and prejudices. You know, one thing to just think about with my PEPA argument, the poor epistemic position argument, is the sheer quantity of people that come through the criminal justice system.
Right.
It's really sad, but 97% of federal cases and 94% of state cases are settled through plea bargaining.
Yeah.
None of them are getting their so-called just desserts because no one is getting their day in court where their acts are judged and then the punishment is distributed in accordance. And part of the problem is just that the state can't afford the resources and time that would be needed to truly determine with each individual case what the punishment would be in terms of just assessing desert.
Right. Right. Yeah. So good. So I take it that, you know, sort of just philosophically, you know, when you make a popular and seemingly intuitive view look bad, you know, the proponents of that kind of view just ask you for the alternative, and then it's just a comparative philosophical argument. If there's nothing better than terrible retributivism, then retributivism wins any debate, right? So the second half of the book, as you'd put it, is devoted to developing your positive account. And so you devote four chapters to developing this alternative approach to managing or dealing with criminal behavior. You call it the public health quarantine model. Mm-hmm. Can you give us the big picture of how that model, that alternative model works?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think that's one of the main contributions of the book. And so it starts with work previously done by Dirk Pirrboom, so I should give him credit. But there's sort of this quarantine analogy part, and then there's this public health part. So let me kind of quickly run through both. The quarantine part is pretty straightforward. So the idea is like, look, if free will skeptics are right, then no one is deserving of punishment. No wrongdoer, no criminal is truly deserving of punishment because essentially no one has the kind of free will or moral responsibility needed to justify purely backward looking practices and judgments. That said, though, like, look, I get on a plane and I come to meet you, Rob, in Nashville in person, let's say. And on my journey, I contract Ebola and I test positive at the airport. Well, I think we'd all agree that the state would be justified in quarantining that individual with the communicable disease. And the justification for quarantine would be grounded in this idea of protecting public health. And so I, in the book, I developed this in terms of the of a right of self-defense and prevention of harm to others. So the idea is that the state would have the standing, the justification for limiting the liberty of this individual without appealing to free will, without appealing to more responsibility or just deserts or retributivism. All they need to do is to justify the limiting of that liberty is to appeal to the right of self-defense and prevention of harm to others. And so the argument is essentially that we could give an analogous justification for the incapacitation of seriously dangerous criminals. So the idea would be we could justify incapacitating serial killers, child molesters, on the grounds that that the state is justified in limiting their liberty on the right of self-defense and prevention of harm to others, analogous to the justification we give for quarantine. And again, we could justify limiting that individual's liberty without appealing to the idea that they deserve it or that they're morally responsible or had free will or need to be given their just deserts. But here's an interesting thing I try to defend in the book is that not only do I think of this view as non-retributive, I also think of it as non-punitive.
Right.
And that we don't generally think that when we quarantine the Ebola patient, that we're punishing them. Punishment usually requires more than just a mere restriction on liberty. Punishment usually involves, or at least legal punishment, typically involves the intentional imposition of harm. It also tends to include a condemnatory or communicative component where the state communicates disapproval both of the agent and what they did. None of that is really present here. And so no intuitive sense are we are punishing the person who has COVID, right? When we quarantine them. And so that would require a whole deal of reform in the criminal justice system if we implemented this kind of quarantine model. And so first it would mean that, you know, less dangerous diseases justify only preventative measures less restrictive than quarantine. Less dangerous criminal tendencies would justify only more moderate restraints, meaning we don't quarantine people for the common cold. We accept a certain amount of risk within society. If I sneeze on you and you get sick, I've caused you some harm, but we don't generally think the common cold is something to quarantine people for. So what we would need to do is assess the things that we currently criminalize, the things we currently incarcerate people for, and the length for which we incarcerate them, and see whether or not it would be justified on my model. And part of what I argue is that many of the things that we currently incarcerate people for would be better served with less restrictive measures. So I adopt something I call the principle of least infringement, which essentially holds that the least restrictive measures should be taken to protect public health and safety. So if you could do something short of quarantine, then you're required to if that measure would protect public health. And the same thing here in the criminal context, that the vast majority of people who are currently incarcerated in the United States are suffering from mental illnesses. Many of them would be better served with mental health services. Many people in the United States are incarcerated either for drug possession or underlying addiction problems that led to petty crime. Many of them would be better dealt with in a less restrictive manner by drug treatment. And so my model is also consistent with the decriminalization of many of the things we currently incarcerate people for. And so I actually called for, in a recent paper, an end on the war on drugs and to decriminalize, personal possession of marijuana and other recreational drugs. And the argument is that those kinds of actions don't reach the level of risk to society and potential harm to others to warrant incapacitation, I claim. But the other big difference is that those people that we do incapacitate, you're not punishing them, right? You're simply limiting their liberty to protect public health and safety. So in this case, the institutions would have to be designed for non-punitive purposes. Our prisons are primarily designed for punitive purposes.
Right.
And the minute individuals get there, they're stripped naked, they're dehumanized, they're isolated. Every aspect of their day is controlled, when they wake up, when they go to sleep, when they eat. And it actually kind of instills a learned helplessness. And it, because of the fact that our prisons are largely cold and, you know, inhumane places, our recidivism rate is outrageous. We have one of the highest recidivism rates in the world. 76.6% of prisoners will be rearrested within the first 5 years of release. Right. So we're not, you know, it's not effective. And so what I would argue is that our institutions then would have to be reoriented toward rehabilitation and reintegration. So like, again, go back to the quarantine case. Well, you got me at the airport, you quarantined me because I have Ebola. Well, you know, you still have a moral duty to treat me and then release me the minute I'm no longer contagious. You no longer have justification for continuing to hold me after I'm no longer a threat. And so I would argue the same bar should be, the same sort of standard should be applied in the criminal context, in that the role of the system should be to rehabilitate and reintegrate individuals as quickly as possible, and that we should adopt the least restrictive measures necessary to protect public safety. And so, you know, I actually give statistics in the book for thinking that this would drastically reduce our mass incarceration crisis. Right. There's actually a study, I think it's by the RAND Institute, that found that nearly half a million people, their study found, are currently incarcerated with that pose no threat to public safety. That is, if you released this half a million people, their argument is that that there would be no increase in risk to public safety. And these are largely people who are aging out in prison, people who committed low-level crimes. And so just alone, if that statistic is even close to accurate, my model would immediately require the release of half a million people.
Right.
Right. Now let me flip over to the public health part. So, sure. You know, as a free will skeptic, people say, well, you know, you owe us an account of what you do for serial killers and child molesters. And so I just sort of gave you that account. We could justify incapacitating them in humane conditions on the grounds of the right of self-defense. But I want to shift our myopic obsession with punishment and reorient the attention to prevention. I want to move us away from a reactive approach to crime to a preventative approach. And this is where the public health part comes in. Public, and this is weird, when I developed this model, no one really had familiarity with quarantine or with public health. And now almost virtually everyone around the planet does. Because right. of this pandemic, and I don't know if that familiarity strengthens or weakens my case, but we have a lot of familiarity now with the idea of tracking disease, with adopting preventative measures like wearing masks, right? Small measures that individuals can do that can help spread, you know, prevent the spread of disease. But public health institutions have been dealing with tracking disease and adopting interventions to prevent outbreaks for a long time. And one of the main things that the public health framework brings is a lens that shifts the focus again from a reactive approach, only addressing things after the problems arise, to both prevention and social justice. So I'll say a little bit about each of those real quick. The prevention part is essentially you have to identify what are the drivers of violent behavior, what are the drivers of crime. And in the book, I label this the social determinants of criminal behavior. And I look at a large wealth of empirical literature, hundreds or thousands of studies. And I try to make the case that the social determinants of criminal behavior are essentially identical to the social determinants of poor health.
Right.
And they include things like poverty and low socioeconomic status, abuse and domestic violence, lack of stable housing, mental illness, lack of access to persistent and stable healthcare and education, environmental health, nutrition. Everyone who even has an inkling about the literature on health can see that these things are really important when it comes to public health. So we know poverty affects morbidity. People in poverty have lower life expectancies, higher rates of type 2 diabetes, higher rates of disease, medical problems. That also is driven by lack of access to healthcare and housing. We also know that, you know, people who are abused, people who've been victims of domestic violence, suffer mental health issues that arise out of that experience. And so if we want to address the poor health outcomes, you know, one of the things the public health framework does is it identifies these social determinants, prioritizes them, and then you adopt basically best practices for trying to address them. And this is where the social justice part comes in. Think of like infant mortality rates in developing countries. Take India, for example, where infant mortality rates are pretty high, right? Children don't survive childbirth or adolescence at higher rates than, let's say, in the West. And then you try to say, okay, that's a poor health outcome. How do we correct that problem? And one of the things you realize very quickly is that the health problems are driven by underlying social inequalities. In this particular case, it might be women's rights issues. In many instances, the low infant mortality is driven by lack of reproductive control over their bodies. Women lack this kind of control over how often they procreate, lack of access to birth control, higher rates of illiteracy, and so dependence on their husbands and their families. If you address the underlying social inequalities, the social injustice, you correct the health outcomes. And so what I argue in the book is that if we want to successfully address criminal justice reform, we can't do so without addressing issues of social justice, because many of the underlying causes of criminal behavior and violence are the outgrowth of the social determinants of criminal behavior, which are driven in, are grounded in things like poverty and low socioeconomic status and racism and domestic violence and housing. And so to properly track violent behavior, we could adopt sort of epidemiological models like we do for disease, where we could actually see how diseases break out, how the Ebola virus spreads and how it breaks out. And they map it in these public health institutions. The same is true now with crime. We could actually see how crime could spread throughout a community. And how crime and violence is often a byproduct of circumstances more than people. And so if you want to alleviate the crimes from occurring in the first place, then the best way to do it is to address these underlying systemic causes of criminality. But yeah, maybe I'll stop there because I'm going on to.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So we are running out of time, Greg, but I just wanted to ask sort of one additional question, mainly about one of the several objections to the positive view that you defend in the book. Sure. So, you know, I can imagine somebody, even just having listened to what you were just saying, I can imagine somebody saying that the public health quarantine model, and indeed the whole approach that you're advocating, seems to entail that being a threat, or being a threat to being a threat to others, not actually threatening them, or not actually committing harmful acts, but being a threat or being at risk for enacting criminal behavior, looks like it would suffice for some kind of treatment by the state. Maybe not full-on quarantine, but some kind of state intervention, even though you haven't done anything harmful, you are well placed to do it. Mm-hmm. Some might think that that's a pretty serious objection. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so I try to head off this kind of concern in the book. I mean, after laying out the theory over a few chapters, I have the last two chapters are my attempt to address various objections to the theory. Yeah. And one of them is sort of this concern. there's a couple of ways. I mean, there's several aspects, I think, of my theory that could try to prevent this. I mean, the first thing I would argue is that, for me at least, the right of liberty has to carry significant weight. And so I always want to place the burden on anyone who wants to limit liberty. So in this case, the burden of proof has to be on the state, right? Because they're trying to limit the liberty of an individual. And so they carry the epistemic burden. That said, I think there's enough of a disanalogy between the quarantine case in the terms of communicable disease and how the incapacitation account would work in the criminal justice arena. So although the underlying justification is analogous, I don't want to give the impression that this is sort of a disease-based model where criminals are viewed as purely diseased, or that the analogy carries through completely. I mean, what's analogous for me is this, that the fact is the justification is analogous. That is, it's grounded in the right of self-defense.
I see. So
the idea would be something like this. Like, look, given the limitations of our current screening methods for criminality, we're nowhere near, right, having any predictive tools that allow us to know with certainty. It's not the Minority Report, right? We don't have the ability at the current moment, and I don't foresee the ability really in the near future to know with certainty whether someone will commit a crime. And given the invasiveness of what would be required in the criminal context, which actually would, in this case, would require probably imprisoning you to observe your behavior, right? So given the invasive, it isn't like I could give you a COVID test.
Right.
I have to basically monitor you, already limiting your liberty. So given the invasiveness and the limited ability to screen for criminal tendencies, and also the likelihood of false positives, I would argue that we should adopt a sort of epistemic skepticism when it comes to judging the dangerousness of individuals. So just like the presumption of innocence works in the courtroom now to protect individuals, where the burden has to be that the state has to prove beyond reasonable doubt that the individual committed the crime, I would say the analogous principle here would be something called the presumption of harmlessness, where the state should presume the individual is harmless and then have to overcome that burden. Now, that might be easy to do when someone commits a crime, because prior behavior is probably the best judge for future behavior. So if someone committed an intentional murder, or someone has already molested, children, then I think the presumption of harmlessness could be overcome, and we could incapacitate the individual on the grounds that it's necessary to protect further victims. But with innocent people, and I should specify, because I think this objection could come in different forms, and people who have criticized my theory sometimes run it in different ways. There's two types of innocence. There's the, let's call them the purely innocent person, the person who hasn't committed any crimes and has no criminal tendencies and poses no threat at all. Well, that'd be pretty clear that my model couldn't justify incapacitating that person, because my model is based on the right of self-defense, and that right could only be triggered when the individual is posing some actual threat, right? An innocent person who hasn't committed any crime and poses no threat would never trigger that right of self-defense where the state could limit that individual's liberty. But what about someone who's innocent in a different sense? They haven't yet committed a crime, but they pose a high potential for committing a crime. What I would do here is make use of certain things that are already done in the law. So for example, take the involuntary hospitalization of the mentally ill. We already allow for some exceptions where we incapacitate people who haven't yet committed crimes. And that might be like a case where someone goes to a therapist and says that they're having thoughts about killing the person they're stalking, or killing their ex-girlfriend. We already know from cases like the Tarsakov case, which is a famous case where a student actually did go to their counselor, said they were going to harm the student. The counselor didn't do anything. The student killed the girl. It was not actually a girlfriend. It was someone he had pursued and had his advances rejected. Since then, counselors and medical mental health experts are required, right, to report that threat. And let's say that that threat is thought to be serious and, you know, et cetera. I would say in certain cases like that, these are really hard cases. These are really difficult ethical cases. There's no easy answers on what the right thing to do in all of them actually is, but we already allow for some incapacitation in those cases. And I would say that would probably continue. But what about a reasons responsive agent? An agent that is responsive to reasons, that, you know, meets all the compatibilist conditions that they specify for free will. What I would argue is that those conditions matter, but not in the way the compatibilist thinks. That is, they matter on my account in a different way. They don't matter for judging blameworthiness or free will, because I don't think those conditions actually get us free will. But I do think that they matter in that because of the right to liberty and the high burden on restricting liberty, I think that you have to give reasons responsive agents the ability to commit a crime first. The state, we might have reasons to reason with them, give them good reasons not to commit those acts. We could admonish them. We could try to weigh their rational deliberation. But given that they're competent agents, I think that the idea is that you have to allow for those interventions, those rational interventions, those argumentative approaches to work or not work. And given the presumption of harmlessness and the high burden the state would have, I would think that in almost all normal cases, on my model, you couldn't justify incapacitating that person until they committed a crime. I do acknowledge that there would be special cases like severe mental illness, cases where people pose a threat and aren't reasons responsive. But I say that the state already does that. And
yeah,
although that area is messy and there are complications, I think that that is already part of our process. So yeah, I think I could avoid, I would say in almost all real life cases, we would not be justified in incapacitating an innocent person.
Got it. Greg, you know, there's a lot left to talk about in the book. So we haven't covered all of the really interesting, fascinating features of the book. And just to tell the audience, one of the real virtues of the book is, you know, there are multiple arguments on every page.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to congratulate you again on the book and thank you for talking to me for New Books in Philosophy.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Great. So thank you, listeners, for joining us. I'll remind you, I've just been talking to Greg Caruso. He has a new book out with Cambridge University Press. It is titled Rejecting Retributivism, Free Will, Punishment, and Criminal Behavior. Thanks for listening to New Books in Philosophy, and bye for now.